My buddy Paul here, just doing a sound check, so I thought I'd click in and say hello. So, can you hear me, Dobbs? Can you hear me, Dobbs? Hello. And we'll let Shello Carker in. We'll talk to Mike Good. So, Dobbs, how you doing? Hello. Hello. Oh, good. You want to say hello?
I do want to say hello just to see whether you can hear me.
Ah, excellent. I can indeed hear you. How is it
Great.
in Sydney?
Very pleasant weather. We've had a very good couple of days. Bright
Excellent.
sunshine, 22 or 23 today, 22 tomorrow. It's been lovely. How's it been your side?
Well, it's a bit muggy up here, but where Mary is, it's quite nice.
Where Mary is, I think you are going to be able to extract her from there, aren't you? Canberra is
Not at the
open.
moment, but it's looking like it'll happen soon. So,
Oh, great.
the Queensland Premier, in her wisdom, has opened up the Queensland border to a bunch of shires which are on the border. So, places like Ballina and Byron Bay and Glen Innes and places like that, but still close to the rest of New South Wales. So, I assume that if all that goes well and New South Wales infection rate stays low, then yeah, she might be up here relatively soon.
Well, my recollection is that ACT is going to direct to Queensland, and I thought that restriction had already been lifted.
Sorry, mate, I missed that because it was breaking up. Can you say that again?
I understood that ACT was able to, will be able to fly and direct as long as it oversees New South Wales.
Yes, we're actually in New South Wales. So we're out at a place called Gundaroo. So Gundaroo is we're about a 30-minute drive from the centre of Canberra, which puts us in New South Wales. So we are apparently, intoxicated with the drug, with the thing. Anyway, let me check on a couple of other people.
Thank you.
Can you hear me now, Paul?
I can, Dobbs. That's great. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Today's a very special day, I thought I would share with you.
Yeah.
It's my 54th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
But of course, Ruth has been dead for 12 years, but we did have 42 of the most fantastic years. And I can tell anyone who wants to know that 18 years difference in our ages didn't matter a bit.
Yeah. My best friend Bob has married Carol. She's 20 years younger than him, and they're both as happy as. So seems like age makes no difference, huh? It's a wonderful thing. Congratulations for making it.
Right.
42 is a long time, hey?
Absolutely. We had
Yeah.
42 fabulous years, but that we were married, what, 54 years ago now.
Wow. That's quite a while.
Yeah, you sound like a youngster, right?
Half a century, mate. Half a century. All right, let me just do a couple of quick other sound checks. I saw Rick out. Rick, how you doing, mate? Give us a quick hello, Rick. Not getting anything there. Anyway, I'm going to assume that you guys can hear me because a couple of you can. So, what we can do is I'll just ask a couple of people to unmute.
Paul, would you be able to turn up your volume?
Turn up my volume.
Correct.
Okay, how's that?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, I do have a little bit of new technology with me, so that may be the issue. All right, I might just do one last sound check while we're fooling around, while I'm fooling around with the the technology. Angela Mellett, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. All right, good to hear your voice. Okay, I'm going to start. So it's 8:03 and we like to have a reputation for starting on time. So my apologies, Julie's not with us, my tech assistant is elsewhere at the moment. So I'm running this whole thing by myself, which apparently is not too difficult to do. If we go offline at some time, I've pressed the wrong button and we'll be back sometime in the future. Anyway, let's assume that we're going to go fine. So on Saturday, we did overcoming self-doubt and building confidence. And it was one of those workshops that just seemed to go like in a flash. It was kind of like all over before we felt like we got into it. So that tells me that the subject was interesting to me and to the people who are involved. So what we're doing now is I'm just going to whip through it in an hour and then do questions if we have time. The purpose of which is just to refresh your mind so that what we know is that if you see these things several times in a row, then they tend to really stick. So that's our plan there. So if we dive straight in, then really self-confidence, if you're looking for a definition, you'd say, well, what it is, or self-doubt, if you're looking for a definition, is it's a lack of another thing, which is confidence in oneself or one's abilities to do the things that we need to do. Interesting enough, self-doubt and depression have been linked by a number of studies. And what they've found is that if self-doubt is allowed to be prolonged, then psychological problems kick in behind it. And those tend to be in the mood swing area, heading towards depression, lower self-esteem, anxiety, that kind of stuff. So when self-doubt causes a loss of motivation, which of course, you know, that's a message of self-doubt, is don't do anything. Because for many people, it looks like self-doubt is sort of a reason why you should stop. Then what happens is concentration and feelings, indecisiveness and guilt and shame and worthlessness show up. And what that means is depression is just around the corner. So it turns out it's a pretty important thing. It occupies a pretty important place in our life. But it does have a place where it can do substantial good. So what self-doubt does, it helps us to recognize we're not always right, and that, in fact, sometimes we need to reflect inwardly to take lessons from things, and that, you know, we could be a bit humble based on our own experiences and self-doubt and, you know, things that we've messed up and those kind of things. And therefore, self-doubt is kind of at the bottom of establishing empathy and compassion. And, you know, those are really, really great qualities to have. So it's not as if self-doubt is all bad. It just tends to be a little bad from the point of view it gets overdone in some ways. When it becomes chronic, and that's probably what we're talking about, its first thing is it becomes amazingly seductive. So self-doubt has an amazing draw power to it. What it says is you have to respond to me now. You have to listen to me now. You cannot continue. Don't think that you can keep doing what you had planned to do. Self-doubt is actually a sign that you should not be continuing in any way whatsoever, and that's its big message. And so one of the things that that does is it stops us from connecting with our innate goodness, the fact that we are a child of God and that, you know, at the deepest level, we are a good person. And so that contributes to wearing away at motivation. And it feels for some people, you know, when we have periods of self-doubt, then it sort of confirms unworthiness and deservability and or lack of deservability, those kind of things, and tends to contribute to a sense of hopelessness. And that convinces that what we should do is expect failure. So the primary role of self-doubt is to create inaction, because what happens is we figure, well, I'm going to fail, so I'd be better off to stop doing what I'm doing. That way I won't fail, and in some form or other I can prevent the possible failure. So it seems like a logical message. However, there's a few problems with it. Now, the way that it shows up is that it says, oh, I've got a whole bunch of things that I'm missing, all right? So I don't have the knowledge that is necessary. I don't have the connections or the teachers or the talent or the skills that are required. I don't even have the courage to get started. And there's 1,000 other rationalizations that we make that say that the self-doubt is actually correct in this assumption that we are going to seriously mess up. Therefore, the primary effect of self-doubt is it causes this complete stop to our momentum. And the reason that it does that is we make a couple of assumptions that are totally wrong. Nevertheless, we make them. And the first assumption that we make is that confidence is actually a critical ingredient of success. In other words, if I'm not feeling confident, I should not be expecting to succeed, regardless of what the thing is that I'm tackling. In fact, if I'm experiencing self-doubt, that is a sure sign that I'm going to fail and that therefore I should not proceed, because who would proceed willingly straight into the jaws of absolute disaster? So that second assumption I've already said, that self-doubt is a sign of impending failure, and who would want to go ahead with that? So as a consequence of that, in order to avoid failure, it says, you know, we should wait, we should procrastinate, we should wait until confidence turns up and self-doubt to pass, as if these are things which are walking around outside our house knocking on the door. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's as if confidence can be bought at the butcher shop, you know, while you're getting your steak, pick up a couple of kilos of confidence. And it's kind of like if you open the front door of your house, maybe self-doubt will walk out and depart and leave forever and never to return. So the interesting thing about that is that the problem we experience is that those things, A, can't happen, and B, we're not doing anything to make them occur anyway, because if you're going to sit on your backside saying, okay, I should not proceed, then why would confidence suddenly show up? You know, if you're not doing anything to make the confidence show up, it's certainly not going to do that. And if you're not doing anything to eradicate the self-doubt, then that's not going to happen either. So it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, and we end up in all sorts of hot water. Because basically, one of the ways of describing the impact of self-doubt is to say it's like a debilitating religion. So it's the characteristics that are similar to a religion is that self-doubt actually has a whole bunch of practices and dogmas and gospels and rituals and processes that keep us kind of involved. And so it's kind of like we believe self-doubt. We believe that we don't have the capacity, just like we would believe that we have a God or we don't have, or whatever it is that you believe. And with the same profound kind of conviction that it is true. And as a consequence of that, what happens is that we worship at the altar all by ourselves, because the people who know us don't understand why we'd be experiencing self-doubt. They've looked at us performing what we do, or, you know, going through the things that we've done, or having the learning experiences we've had over the course of our life, and they think, why would you be experiencing self-doubt? But of course we are. So what we do is we worship at the altar of self-doubt by ourselves, suffering all the time from the consequences of that self-doubt, when most people look at us and go, don't understand why you would be. We have a number of methods for doing that. And first cab off the rank, not necessarily the most important, but first one comes to mind, is the I can't syndrome. What that boils down to is we're convinced that we can't do something because, you know, we don't have the skills or the talent or the ability or stuff I said just a minute ago. And when we're convinced that we can't succeed, well, we imperceptibly make less effort. And as we make less effort, then things start to slow down, so momentum starts to vanish, and, you know, we're saying to ourselves, why would I bother when it's already kind of like a guaranteed thing that I'm going to fail? And so as we put in less effort, then what happens is we actually increases the chances that we're not going to succeed, and that reinforces our own negative beliefs, and that creates a vicious cycle, and we go round and round and round with that. So many people do that. It's the I can't syndrome, very popular out there. The self-sabotage syndrome is very popular as well. And basically that's the I didn't, you know, and I didn't because I don't know how, and I didn't get to it and whatever. So self-sabotage actually emerges from a fear of failure. It's when we're so petrified about failing that we can't take our minds off it, that produces things going wrong that are very difficult for us to predict. And most people who suffer from self-sabotage will tell you that they are very creative with it, and they can make self-sabotage turn up out of nowhere, and that they can invent new ways to sabotage, you know, ad infinitum, so to speak. Self-sabotage loves procrastination because they can get together and create a disaster that's virtually impossible to get over. So if you keep that up for too long, then, well, eventually that all leads to what you're hoping to avoid all along, which is you actually start to believe that you're incapable of success because you've forgotten how well you do when you try. And so when we have people, say, for example, someone with a fear of speaking in public, the major thing they suffer from is, I'm going to make a fool of myself. And so who would get up on stage when you're pretty certain that's what's going to happen? So they avoid getting up on stage, so they have no experience of edging their way towards a victory. They don't ever start talking to one person, scale it up to two people, and then, you know, a small crowd of three, and then possibly four, and then five. And so they've forgotten what it's like to tackle something and have a success. And interesting enough, later on, when we get to talk about confidence, confidence is actually the feeling that we derive from overcoming obstacles as we go through our life. It's not actually, confidence doesn't actually come from succeeding. But we'll talk more about that in depth as we get to it. The next method for perpetuating self-doubt is to get into the imposter syndrome. We have a separate session on imposter syndrome. I think it wasn't very long ago we did it, so you can check that out on the website. And basically, the imposter syndrome is that feeling that I'm a fraud and that I'm going to have to disguise the fact that I feel like I'm lucky to have got wherever I've got to. Any victories that I've had have been through luck or somebody helping me or an unfair advantage or whatever it is. And the imposter syndrome simply gets us to disregard ability or learning or skill or personal application or effort or any of that development that we go through. And so imposter syndrome is basically waiting to be discovered, or it's you waiting to be discovered and then publicly humiliated or announced as an imposter or as a fraud. And the imposter syndrome by itself is going to, you know, well, is famous for stopping more people than there are grains of sand on a beach. Lots of people just figure, look, I'm terrible at this. I'm no good at it. I'm hopeless. I'm never going to get there. So there's a lack of compassion extended towards themselves. Once again, we've done some work on that, so you can check that out if you like. Research reveals that a lack of self-kindness is actually a precursor to self-doubt. So if you're wondering, how else do we create self-doubt? Well, one of the ways is that we be a bit nasty to ourselves. So if you are the inner critic towards yourself, then you are propelling yourself in the direction of self-doubt, or more self-doubt than you currently experience. When people are, or people who are kinder to themselves, they tend to accept rather than deny that they're deficiencies, and that they're better able to encourage themselves to be better. So being kind to yourself extends compassion, extends understanding and willingness to forgive, and a capacity for us to be forgiving towards ourselves as we would to another person. We then went ahead and did an exercise, and it was to write down all the ways in which you experienced self-doubt. People on the day made a list. You could do that right now if you want. If you're hearing this material for the first time, no reason why you couldn't just make a quick note about the different ways in which you experience self-doubt, you know, whether that's speaking up for yourself, or whether it's admonishing someone who needs to be corrected, or whether it's changing the direction that a family or a business is going in, or making decisions about what you want to do with yourself in terms of amusement, or whatever it is that you know, that may come to your list. If you make a list, then that's a really cool thing to do, because what it does is it enables you to go to the next part of the exercise, which is to say, okay, which one of those does the most damage to you? Because that would be the place where you would start. That would be the place where you would look to impact and say, okay, so I can't work on all of these things. Let's just work on the one that's doing the most damage. And in my experience, working with people day in and day out, we don't need to fix everything. We just need to fix a few key things. And I'd much prefer that you had two or three things you're working on than a dozen. A dozen creates the whole scatterbrained, hypervigilant kind of OCD thing. So, you know, when we can boil it down to a few core things, you know, I'm much happier when my clients have fewer goals rather than more goals. So be aware of that. That gives you some personal development to be working on. When it comes to overcoming self-doubt, there's a number of processes or techniques you can get involved with. Michael, you got your hand up, so I'll just interrupt there. You got a question, mate?
Well, it has to do with volume. For a few seconds, a moment ago, you closer to the bike than the spine. Can you see if that's the fish? That's all.
I missed most of that, mate.
The mic. You are a wee bit too far away from the mic.
Okay, how's that?
It's a bit better.
Bit better?
Yes, okay. Please. That's great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let me make an adjustment that might keep that difference a permanent thing rather than temporary. This is a new bit of equipment, so you guys can just put up with me these adjustments here. I can get that thing close. All right, Mike, how is that? How's that for volume?
Improved considerably. Thanks, Paul.
Improved. Okay, I'm going to keep an eye on my screen. If your hand goes back up again, mate, I'll stop and we'll see what else we can do. Okay, thanks for letting me know about that. Okay, when it comes to what are the techniques, what are the processes that we can use to overcome self-doubt, then we have to look at being the observer. In other words, we have to look at breaking the cycle. We have to look at how you can tap into your own ability to see what's going on in your life. And so the process I'd recommend is that you stop what you are doing. You articulate what you are thinking or feeling. That could be, you know, making some notes on your pad, or it could be talking to someone if they're with you, if someone that you can confide in is with you. But it may just be a mental note that you make about what's going on. And then locate where those feelings are in your body and listen to the thoughts. And then ask yourself, just remind yourself to stay present, because what you'll find is if you come into the present moment, self-doubt will go away, because self-doubt is related to the future. It's anticipating a disaster. So it's a version of fear. And so the way that we get around that, or one of the ways of getting around that, is just bring ourselves in the present moment. You'll see that this four-step process here has some similarities to emotional healing, but they're only similarities. At this point, what we're doing is we're saying, don't try and do anything with it. Just be aware of it and stay in the present, and then go back to doing whatever the thing that you were doing and go from there. The other thing you can do is acknowledge your judgment. And what I mean by that is that we are not necessarily we're not hardwired for happiness. Our brain is actually, its primary function is to ensure our survival. So our brain is dominated by the assessments it needs to make sure that we don't walk into a disaster. And if you go back 60,000 years when we were nomadic, some of these disasters could be instantly fatal. So those functions in our brain are still there. So we still need to be aware of what's going on from that point of view and understand we're not automatically hardwired for happiness. We can run into a big victory and then start worrying about the victory vanishing. In fact, it's one of the things that happens to lottery winners. You know, they collect the money and then they start panicking about losing it through bad investments or bad advice or those kind of things. It's sort of like, you know, the joy of being suddenly rich doesn't last very long, because it converts quickly into how do I protect myself from possible disasters. So that's hardwiring in the brain. So therefore, what we do is we tend to constantly question our decisions. The problem with that is that if you're constantly questioning your decisions, then the decisions don't get much time to kind of come home to roost and take root in the life and enable you to kind of go forward confidently. So the technique you should use is to say, okay, my system has told me that there's potential danger here. I need to acknowledge that to my system. I need to tell my brain, okay, I'm aware that, you know, there's possible danger here, and I can move on and be present and handle what's going on right at the moment. Next step in dismissing, the next step in overcoming self-doubt is dismissing worry. I'm just going to use one single quote for that. It comes from the Dalai Lama. I love this quote. He says, if a problem is fixable, if a situation is such that you can do something about it, then there's no need to worry. That's primarily because you can get on with fixing it. He says, alternatively, if it's not fixable, then there's no help in worrying. Therefore, there is no benefit in worrying whatsoever, which is why Buddhists tend to be so cheerful, is that they realize all the things we could be worrying about, maybe we don't need to, because they're not actually producing a result. You can't pull this off without a bit of practice. So it's fine for me to sit here and say, you know, stop worrying. What you'll have to do is say, okay, I understand the concept, but I'm going to have to work at that And if any of you are prone to anxiety, then what you'll notice is that worry just comes up automatically. And let me remind you that worry coming up automatically is fair enough, but all it is your system, your survival mechanism, keeping an eye out for you. And all you've got to do is just let it know that you're okay, and that if you consistently go to that, then you'll find that worrying can be, you know, can be put off into the background. Another thing we talk about with worry is compartmentalizing things. You know, worry about it when it's happening, not now. Get prepared, do all that, but, you know, kind of move on. Other things we do when we're talking about overcoming self-doubt is find ways to get it out of our system. So if you have someone you can talk to, that's great. Maybe you do better with writing. Maybe you do better with painting. In fact, I was talking to a client this week who is feeling all wound up because he hasn't been painting, and he's an artist and that's his thing. And so there's been, he's been so hard at work that he hasn't been getting to express himself via his art, and so he's all wound up. And so it was a fairly simple thing for me to say to him, mate, for the sake of the business and for the sake of everybody, because he manages a business that's doing $2 million a year, he for the sake of the business, he needs to take some time out of the business to do some painting to restore normality in his own mind. So whether it's talk, whether it's write, whether it's paint, doesn't really matter. Basically, if you understand how we've got to work with this, you'll know that we need to get it out of our system. This is a quote from Marcus Aurelius, famous Roman emperor. And he said both of these things. He said, if you're distressed by anything external, the pain is not due to the thing itself, but to your estimate of it, your assessment of it. And he says, you have the power to change your view at any moment. He's got another beautiful quote that says, you don't have to make a thing of this. And I love that. It may be just that's, you know, I've got a propensity to do that, get wound up about something. And when he says, you don't have to make a thing of this, I think that's such a beautiful expression. We could just let this thing be this thing and not have a judgment about it. And therefore, we don't have to kind of get emotionally wound up about it. The other thing that's going to help is to stop comparing yourself. It is very easy to see how well other people have done and compare ourselves to what they've done, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when you look at what other people have done, you've got to ask yourself, are you going to use that destructively? In other words, you know, hammer yourself, or are you going to use it as inspiration, which would make it constructive? So it's really important that we look at what other people achieve, and there's always somebody who's done it bigger, better, faster or something. Then it's really important that we focus on not allowing the pangs of jealousy to last too long. They're going to show up. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, at least we can catch them and say to ourselves, you know, well, okay, jealousy is telling me that I'm feeling small, when what I really want to do is feel big. So I need to turn towards turning that to inspiration. This is a quote from Rumi, who was a 14th century poet. And he said, don't be satisfied with stories and how things have gone with others. Unfold your own myth. Once again, another beautiful saying. You could probably put that quote, unfold your own myth, somewhere prominent in your surroundings. Basically what it says is run your own story, live your own life, be you, there's no one else like you, etc. Four words to describe all that, pretty amazing concept. Next thing is to depersonalize everything. This is something that people find difficult to do when they first come across our material. You guys would be pretty good at it. And basically what it says is, you know, what would you say to your child if they came to you experiencing self-doubt because they had failed at something, messed something up, blown it, embarrassed themselves or done whatever? And generally speaking, what a parent is going to say to a child is, this failure does not define you. This failure is not you. It's something that you had a go at. And in fact, if you wanted to look at it from the outside, what you'd see is that this is really kind of a sign. The failure is actually a sign that you're willing to have a go and take a risk. And it's actually a really good thing in terms of your character and your substance and the quality of the human being that you are. That's the kind of thing a parent would say to a child. Interesting enough, if you get that, and if you're a parent, you'll get it straight away. if you understand failure is not personal, then you could ask yourself the question, well, should success be personal? In other words, should I be riding high on the wave of victories when I have them, or are victories equally as unpersonal, equally as unrelevant, equally as not you? You know, if we are not our behaviors, well, that means we're not our failures and we're also not our successes. Our successes can come through intense personal effort, but they're not you. They're just kind of like a display of where you put your energy. That can help keep you humble and make sure you don't get overcome by massive successes. So that's a pretty cool idea. Then we talked about becoming the optimist, and pretty much you know how this is going to go. We can argue until the sun comes down or until we go blue in the face about whether the glass is half full or half empty, but we've got to ask ourselves who's having most fun. And obviously the people who think that the glass is half full are having more fun than the people who got the glass half empty, and it's the same amount of water. So, important that we kind of choose to look on the bright side of whatever presents itself to us to get through life. Next thing is we need to embrace failure. There's going to be plenty of it. You know, it's a staggering concept to see that if you ask an educator, what is the way that people most often learn, then the answer is going to be by failing, you know, by trying to write an essay and making a mess of it. In my case, by trying to plane a piece of wood. When I was teaching woodwork, eventually when I ended up teaching this kind of material, then it came from teaching and not succeeding at getting the ideas across and not having them, the concepts transfer from my mind to the next person's mind. So failure is definitely the planet's most common teaching mechanism. And yet what we want to do is avoid it like the plague. When you think about it, it's basically impossible to get from where you are now to the end of your life without significant, recurring, troublesome, persistent, gut-wrenching, worrying failure. Failure is a part of every person's life. What we need to do is understand that if we have a good relationship with failure, then we won't necessarily see it as failure. We might admit that it didn't work very well, but we will go on to say, how do I turn that to my advantage? How do I turn that to a good thing? Simple concepts. In embracing failure, what we need to understand is that failure is actually only a personal thing if you turn it into that. It's just an event. So if you turn it into it, well, then you've got the responsibility to turn around, because you see, otherwise it's more often a sign of impending success, because the more you fail, the more you're progressing towards getting to the point where when you do that thing the next time, it's not going to be a failure. There was a time when I had no success in teaching adults, and you know, the more I went on, the worse it felt, but the closer I was getting to the day when it actually succeeded. And that's true of anything that we do, whether you're learning to touch type or play the guitar, the more failure, the closer we are to success. But not many people think about it that way. But here's a big one. Becoming good at something involves dealing with a very confronting reality, and that is, at the moment, you are terrible at the thing that you want to be good at, and that's a bit kind of in your face. That's why I say it's confronting. You know, what practice does, if you've got to practice a piano or the guitar or the touch typing or whatever, what practice does is it rubs your poor performance all over your face, because you sit down there at the keyboard yet again for another hour's practice, and it's torture because you can't feel any sense of progress. Progress is actually being made, but you can't feel it. And you won't feel it until it's significant. You know, if you made progress at the rate of 1% per day, what it means is you're only 100 days, you're only 3 months away from 100% increase in your capacity to do this thing that you're willing to practice for an hour a day. That is just ridiculous. If that was yoga, mate, you'd end up turning yourself into a pretzel. But you wouldn't necessarily feel like you were succeeding along the way. You might see signs of movement, but you're always going to be getting the feedback that your body won't quite reach to where you want it to. That's because you're asking it to go further every time. And so we tend to not be good with practice simply because we interpret it the wrong way. when we are not succeeding because of our practice or with our practice, when our practice is not giving us positive feedback, that makes us uncomfortable because that feeds into, oh, I'm not very good, and bingo, we go from there. We're not good at being uncomfortable. And because we're not good at being uncomfortable, then it turns out to be weeks between the times that we pick up the guitar and have a go. It turns out to be months between when we sit down and do a proper keyboard lesson in terms of how to touch, type, or whatever. And yet, if you think about it, what practice does is it teaches you a really, really important concept, and that is that you can overcome the obstacles that present themselves to you, even if you don't know what the obstacles are going to be. That, my friends, is actually confidence, which we'll go on and talk about. I'm chewing up time here, so I better move on. So really what I'm saying is practice is a confidence builder, because not because we build confidence because we're getting better because of practice. What I'm saying is practice allows us to build confidence because as we succeed, we realize, hang on, I'm succeeding because I stayed with the uncomfortable bit. I can be uncomfortable, getting negative feedback, and still progressing. So I'm not saying practice is a confidence builder because practice means you get better. You could actually practice wrong. So the practice does need a bit of kind of direction about it. That's why we do go to a music teacher, those kind of things. And we did the exercise and said, okay, those are the things that are going to eradicate self-doubt or at least dramatically impact on it. This is a summary of the things that I've just said. I started with become the observer, moved on to practice, practice, practice. So what that's a list there. What you would do is just grab your top two and just say to yourself, okay, which of these do I need to put the most effort into it? So when I say the top two, if you put a circle around one or two of those things, you'd be doing that because you're saying, I'm the worst at that. I'm hopeless at that. I really need to get onto that because I just don't ever bother to use it. So which of these ones do you either use the least or use least effectively, put a circle around that, and that becomes the area that you should direct yourself in as you move forward with your personal development. As I'm fond of saying, that should go into your personal development folder, is to put some time and effort into that concept. If you try and work on all of those, then you'll just get overwhelmed. So like I said, don't get over busy with personal development. As personal development and self-help are kind of like, they're kind of like killed off by trying to do everything at once. And lots of people go at it really, really hard, but they just overload themselves. You know, by its very nature, personal development and self-help need a slow and steady and constant approach rather than a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and kind of keep it going as fast as we can. When we go to confidence, then essentially what we're saying about confidence is that confidence is an emotion. And so you would have heard me talk about emotions, and I say there's six basic emotions, but sure, there's 400 others. Well, confidence is one of the 400 others. And so confidence is this sense that everything is going to be okay, that I can actually take something on. It's a physical sensation, shows up in your body. Interesting enough, it'll show up as a deeper breathing, a longer breath cycle, a relaxedness in our body language. There's a whole bunch of physical sensations that we will feel in our body as we are experiencing confidence. But this confidence comes from our brain's wild imaginings. And what I mean by that is that we can imagine that we're going to succeed, and suddenly we relax and muscles, the tension goes out of the neck muscles and we breathe a lot easier. But that's just because we're imagining something. It's not actually something that's happening. And I'm fond of standing in front of crowds and saying, everybody close your eyes. I'm going to pick one man and one woman to come up the front and give us a talk, and watching people around the room freeze while they've got their eyes closed. And they're freezing, they've gone into paralysis because of their wild imaginings, because what they're imagining is that I'm going to pick them and I'm going to make them go up the front and give a talk, and they're going to be embarrassed, they're going to make fools of themselves, it's all going to be terrible, but it hasn't happened yet. It's a long way from happening. And so that's what I mean by there's that person, they burst into a sweat, they're breathing heavily, and body temperature's going up, their heart's pounding, and that's created by wild imaginings, because we're not actually going to get them up on stage. We were just kind of just messing with them. So you can see how easy it is to mess with this. So that's why you would have heard me say on numerous occasions, your emotions are relevant, you're entitled to them, but by heck, you better understand they are notoriously unreliable. If we have a look at some facts about confidence, then the truth is there's absolutely no link between being confident and experiencing success. And you know that yourself, because there's been times when you've been successful when you had no confidence, and you've also failed when you were sure that you were about to kick a goal. So we've all had lots of experience of that not being true. So kicking goals does not create confidence. What I mean by kicking goals is having successes. You know, you can have a million successes and still lack confidence. So confidence is actually an opinion. So it's both an emotion and an opinion. It's an emotion created by an opinion. When you look at it, confidence moves the stock market more than what we call the basic fundamentals. It also influences how golfers putt for the championship. And, you know, when a golfer is putting for the championship and feeling the pressure, the chances are their putting technique is going to go to pack, because they're going to lose their confidence, and then they're going to try and manipulate the ball in there. It's all going to go wrong. So confidence drives things like the stock market, like the economy, like who people vote for. And so confidence controls enormous things. But if you said, what is confidence? Well, it's just a bunch of opinions. It's just a bunch of... In the case of the stock market, there's a large body of opinion. It's kind of like, you know, how many people are on the bull side as compared to how many people are on the bear side. And whatever's got the biggest numbers tends to win because they act accordingly. So people make their trades based on their confidence of in their system, so to speak, and what they think is going on in the market and those kind of things. Ridiculous concept when you think about it, because what it means is when we go to do things like that, you know, should I sell my house or should I do a renovation on it? All of those sort of things, that is a confidence move, not a logical one. It never really is a logical one, because confidence is going to overcome it. And of course, the problem with confidence is that there's six reasons why I should not sell, and there's six reasons why I should sell. So I've got six of one and half a dozen of the other, and I'll become confused, and that creates self-doubt. Second thing to look at is standing up. What we know is that body language is an essential part of confidence. And so your body sends as many messages to your brain as your brain sends to your body. So what we know is that you can, if you want to get someone off the phone because the conversation's gone a bit long, all you have to do is stand up. They will notice a change in tone of your voice. But if you're giving a presentation or asking for the sale, stand up for sure. Also, practice being present. It's really important that we stay with what is happening with us in the moment. So, you know, when we talk about mindfulness and being present, lots of people hear me say a word which is, you know, mindfulness is a word similar to meditation. And because I say it so often, and because I say practice mindfulness and practice meditation so often, they tend to lose their impact because I use the word so often. But, you know, one of the things that we need to understand is that we know that these things can be fitted into a normal day. And if we do, then what happens is the whole day goes better. So for most people, they know that they should be being more mindful and they should be meditating more, but they have trouble fitting it into the day. And what I'm going to suggest is that is completely wrong. That is a completely wrong view of what mindfulness and meditation is, because you see, I'm going to suggest that the mindfulness exercises that I've given you in a class, and as I look at my list, all of you have been in a class with me at some point or other, they all revolve around the only things we can do in a class. So most of you have done walking mindfulness exercises with me, or sometimes called walking meditation. Or we talk about, you know, how to do the washing up. Those are examples that we use. Those are really just there as illustrations. I'm not seriously suggesting that you should be walking around your lounge room. I'm suggesting that's training for you to practice or to become aware of the practice of being aware of your thoughts and feelings. If you direct your mind to your thoughts and feelings as you are doing whatever you are doing during the day, and trust me, this is fundamental to our work. This is fundamental for what Global Success Academy is trying to teach. If you bring your awareness to your thoughts and to your feelings, then you have the power to adjust them. And as you have the power to adjust them, then you step out of being unaware or unconscious and you step straight into being powerful. And that, my friends, is the key to living the life that you want. When you want to do a mindfulness exercise, if you want to do it for the sake of doing it, if you're saying to yourself it would be good to do that, then the questions to ask yourself is, what's going on with my body? And you might ask yourself where your hands are, or can you feel your bum in the seat? You might just check in on your breathing. You might have a look at, can you lengthen your breathing? Or what's what do you see when you look straight ahead? Are there sounds? Are there tastes? Are there smells? Is there anything that else is relevant that connects me to what is happening right now? Because as you connect to what is happening right now, you connect to your truest self. Next thing to look at is transforming fear. And so, as I've said, the body sends just as many messages to the brain as the brain assigns to the body. So one of the distinctions that most people never make is that fear and excitement are actually the same base sensation channeled through what we call good and bad channels. And so if you think about what happens to you when you get afraid, then it could be that your palms sweat, or that your body shakes, or that you sweat, or those kind of things. Those are exactly the same things that happen when you get excited. So it's the same energy going through different channels. Not really sure how else to say that. You'll notice the sensations in your body exactly the same. So we call fear and excitement a pair, an emotional pair. They're kind of like the twin sides of a coin. And when you flip the coin, it's going to come up one way or the other, but the other one's just right there. You know, you can't have one without the other. So another twin set of emotions is joy and sadness. And the reason we say that is the same kind of energy, and that energy in our body, you know, we say you can have tears of joy and you can have tears of sadness. So that's another twin, like this twin that we've got in front of you. The joy and sadness is just an illustration that you can have this energy flowing through a good channel and a bad channel, or what we call good and bad, and that it's the same energy. Therefore, you can shift it. You can actually transform fear into excitement. I've had to do it to get on stage on many an occasion. So I know that it's a simple, straightforward thing if you practice. The other thing that, you know, you're going to hear me saying every time we get together is that without doing something about your body, then what happens is that it's going to start to take control. And so, you know, the fatter we get, or the slower we get, or the older we get, or the stiffer we get, or the less flexible we get in our body, then the more that is reflected in our minds. And that's a pretty straightforward downhill straight. So we've got to take care of that. So what we know is that when you exercise intently, and I'm saying be careful about that if you're going to start something, what it does, it releases endorphins, and those things are the equivalent of opium or heroin in terms of the beautiful rush that they give you, this intense rush of euphoria. Probably euphoria is the best description for it. So that's a great way of creating a state of mind. And that pleasurable state of mind tends to ensue, and it tends to get us to look at things more positively, so that when we tackle problems and difficulties, we are more assertive and we're more capable and we have more energy to bring to the situation. So feeling stronger physically literally translates directly into feeling stronger in every other way possible. So hop into it. It's a critically important thing to your longevity and to the quality of your life. The other thing we talked about was visualizing success. And so we had an exercise here, and, you know, I had everybody imagining what your world would be like if you had unlimited confidence. So what would you do differently? How would you walk? How would you talk? How would you play and work differently? Would you treat yourself in a different kind of way? What would you say to yourself? What characteristics would you bring forward and display in the world? Are there things you would start doing that you've never done before? Are there things that you would stop doing that have been holding you back? Are there goals and targets you would allow yourself to set for? Would your relationships change? So, you know, there's any number of possibilities there. These are just triggers to help you visualize what success would look like for you if confidence was at the level that you imagine it to be or wanted it to be at. To do that, what we've got to do is we've got to be clear about our goals. And so goals play a really important part in people's lives, and basically making progress towards a goal which has meaning to us, and it has to have meaning to us, that's really the foundation of healthy self-confidence. Healthy self-confidence being the kind of confidence that you don't have to tell anyone about. You just allow yourself to get on with it. So remember, a positive self-image, well, by itself, that doesn't produce anything. We get a sustainable confidence from our positive and our productive behavior. We've got to get our self-image to express itself through our actions. And so Martin Seligman is good for this quote. He says, well-being cannot just exist in our own head. It's a combination of actually having meaning and accomplishment. So we've got to get out there and get on with it. We've talked already about speaking kindly to yourself and treating yourself with kindness. You know, it's a funny thing. We love validation from other people. And what we need to understand is whilst it's nice, it's a trap, because if you don't have your own, then the validation for others wears off so quickly that it's kind of like almost not there, which condemns us to having to go get some more. You'll know that I've praised Brené Brown's work for a long time. So this is a quote that really works from her. Talk to yourself like you would talk to someone you love, with tenderness and with kindness, and treasure that person. Treasure that person that is you. But most importantly, embrace discomfort. You see, to get where we want to get to, we're going to have to be experiencing difficulties, obstacles, and things that we need to overcome, and feeling uncomfortable. And so confidence is a perception within ourselves that we don't lack what we need to get to where we want to get to. That, you know, it could be said as it's having a trust in our own abilities or capacities or judgments or whatever. In reality, it's the feeling that we can meet whatever today's challenges are going to be without knowing what the challenges actually are going to be. Of course, people like to get prepared, but, you know, there's a lot of challenges going to turn up. There's no time for preparation. And so confidence comes from what I was talking about with practice before. Confidence actually comes from overcoming things which were difficult in the past. So if we overcome things which are difficult, sooner or later those things become in our past. And we look back on our track record and it tells us, you know what, pretty much whatever's going to happen, I'll cope with it. I'll handle it. Mark Manson's quote, this is a guy who wrote The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. When we're comfortable with negative experiences, it allows us to act without fear, to engage without judgment, to love without conditions. That's a magical quote when you think about it. We then went on to do an exercise, and the exercise pretty much said, okay, I've talked about a bunch of concepts here, given you a list. There's the list right there. Have a look at that and say, okay, if I was going to pick one or two of these to work on, because if I pick the whole lot, I'll overwhelm myself. If I was going to pick one or two of these to work on, then which one or two would it be? Put a circle around them and put that into your self-development strategy or plan. What is the bottom line? Well, basically, what we've done in the past 50-odd minutes or so is talked about a whole bunch of strategies for eradicating self-doubt and building confidence. But I've got a warning for you. A healthy sense of self-confidence is not something that you build and then it's done and it's over and you're finished, right? It's not kind of like a do it once and you're good forever. You're going to need to practice. You're going to have ups and downs. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have failures. Things are going to go haywire, even when you've planned, you know, to the end of the world. So even if you feel like you're going backwards, just come back to basics and get back on track. It's really important that you do that. Real self-confidence is part courage, part confidence, with a healthy dose of self-compassion mixed in. And that was our day. There was lots of interaction. There was lots of questions. There was lots of discussion. We don't have the room for that at the moment. I will get straight on to recommended reading. There's a couple of things there. That's a YouTube talk on the bottom of your screen. You can see the play button there. It won't play for you if you press it, but if you go to the TED website or YouTube and type in Amy Cuddy, that lady's name is Amy, A-M-Y, C-U-D-D-Y, then she gave that talk in 2012. And it's a great explanation of how body language impacts on moving self-doubt out and bringing confidence in. And, you know, the good thing about TED Talks is they don't go forever, so you can get some great information. By far the most outstanding book of the three up the top there, and I am recommending all three of them, but the one that's head and shoulders above the rest is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. And I would suggest that there's a great primer for that. Her TED talk, which goes for about 17 or 18 minutes, is a great piece of work as well. So hop into that. You can download the worksheets from the website. That's an image of them there. Just go to the website and download those so that you can work your way through those. It's another way of processing the information. Mary and Julie build those things. And here is a self-assessment sheet put together by Mary and Julie, and that will allow you to figure out where you are in terms of how much self-doubt and how much confidence and what you need to do. And it'll give you a score, and you can work out just whether this is one of the big things for you or not. And then in terms of things we've got on next, right now we're in the middle of the next day Q&A. Our next workshop is on assertiveness, which is kind of, if you think about it, it's a logical extension of confidence. And, you know, if we can nail self-doubt and we can build a quiet confidence within ourselves, and that we are halfway there to understanding assertiveness. And assertiveness is kind of like the bomb in terms of getting what you want, being able to get your message across without being aggressive or without being passive. So assertiveness is a solution to passive aggressive. And so most of us have been taught to be passive aggressive because of our backgrounds, and it hasn't really worked. And assertiveness is the big deal. So we're doing that on the 17th of October. Hopefully the borders will open by then. Meanwhile, we'll see about that. You can post about your progress on the Facebook group. We would hope that you share victories and failures on there so that we can you can share each other, you know, being a like-minded group, that kind of thing. And I can do some coaching and help you out with that whenever you want the help from that level. So that's the information. That's the review of what we did on Saturday. If you were there on Saturday and you've done the worksheets, well, this is now your third trip through the material. It's certainly my third trip through the material, probably my fifth or my seventh or whatever, because I made the slides, etc. So that means that we internalise the material. It's a pretty good way to go. We've got a few minutes left for questions, which is probably the major reason why you're here with us. So what you need to do if you want to ask a question is to find the little icon that's got the blue hand on your control panel. Click on that. That'll show up on my screen, and I can invite you to unmute yourself and ask away. And that means ask a question, provide a comment, share a victory or a failure or whatever you want to do. In fact, we've got a few minutes just to chat. So over to you guys in the form of questions, comments, ideas or sharings. Ready, set, go. Okay, sounds like we're good. I'll just make a last call for questions. What this means is we either have done a hopeless job or we have very thoroughly covered the material. So I'm going to take the option, being a glass half full person, I'm going to take the option of saying we must have very thoroughly covered the material. So in that case, been great to be with you. Thanks for joining us on this review of the material. Hope to see you at the next gig. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Paul.
Pleasure, mate. Bye.